And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 13th, 2020. We will not, and you would even mention the fact that it will be Friday the 13th because things are going okay. We don't want to call that no hitter just yet, right? Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well, and I'm excited to talk to you today about the new president-elect, Joe Biden, and Kamala Harris, MVP. We're going to be talking about the hope and challenges for climate that the new administration will bring, so tune in.
So, in case you didn't notice, there's been an election going on for the last several weeks. It seems to have dragged on forever. But in fact, Joseph Robinette Biden is the president-elect of the United States. And his running mate, Kamala Harris, will now be Madam Vice President. Somebody said that she's going to be the MVP. Madam Vice President-elect. The MVP. Anyway, they're in. Right? Done. Going to be president. We talked in the last show about the kinds of things that a president-elect Biden could do, either by executive order or by action in the Senate. And, of course, there's a whole swirl of information there. But I thought we would take a moment, Mariah, and talk a little bit about, the politics, right? The election's behind us now. We can talk politics or who got elected, why they got elected, what they think about. Is that a fair topic for us to head down? Or do you want to take a moment
and congratulate all the president-elect? What's that? Well, I tell you, I really want to congratulate the vice president-elect because that brought tears to my eyes, right? You know, here we have this, not just the first woman, but the first both Black and Asian American, but Indian woman. I mean, it was just outstanding. And I've been listening to so many things where, you know, women are saying my daughter now can look and have a path forward. And it just was really emotional. So yes, I'm happy for Biden too, but I'm really, really, really happy for Kamala Harris. Yay.
As we all are. Well, so let's begin with a couple things. One is the concept that Biden has a climate mandate. All right, let's begin with the idea. So there was an editorial piece in the Boston Globe by Leia Stokes, who is a scientist from on the West Coast, a climate scientist on the West Coast, basically saying that, look, folks, Joe Biden talked a lot about climate. He proposed a $2 trillion climate rescue plan. Basically, he won big. He's got now more than 5 million votes. He's ahead. He's got the Electoral College. He's got a big advantage in the percentage of votes. We got to face the fact that people want him to act on climate. Is that a fair statement, Mariah? Do you see it that way?
I do. I think that there's been some, this is a whole different rabbit hole, but there's been some data that, some polls that support that. I also know that going into the election, I think that, let's see, Yale's climate opinion maps said that it was maybe, I have the numbers. I think it was less than half saw climate as a voting priority. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is because it's still quite partisan. Although it's changing a little bit with younger audiences. I do think that a lot of the polling showed that Biden, people put climate as their top priority. I think that CNN had said 75% of the exit polls.
I saw a thing on Fox on the day of the election. Fox was showing a poll of issues. Fox with someone else, right? But they say that 70% of the people favored action on climate, right? Some fraction more enthusiastically than others, but when you net it out, 70% of the people in a Fox News poll wanted to have action on climate change. And I guess so the whole question of how accurate these polls are is something we can come back to, because we have to talk through. Too, go ahead.
The wording, you know, action on climate change also doesn't mean much, right? It could mean that they're thinking, yeah, we need to manage the forests better because that's the real problem with climate change, right? So, I think that there's, it can be hard to see which of those, what do they really mean in those polls? And also, 47% of this country voted for a president who says that climate change is a hoax, right? So that also kind of indicates that maybe those numbers are a little convoluted. So anyways.
I was going to say we have yet to come and process the idea that people voted for Biden, but also did not vote for all those progressive senators, right? That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
Right?
But
I guess I would make the case. I think that because of the poison pill nature of climate up to now, the fact that Biden ran on climate and won, despite the fact that half the country may be 47% may not like it very much, I think that I would argue that he's got a duty to act because he's made those promises and that he's got enough will behind him to justify going ahead, right? We can agree to disagree.
I think that it should be more will. I really think that is a significant problem in our country right now. And I think that's where we're both heading in the end, right?
Well, then I saw this article that said, given the risk that Trump represented of continuing denial, another 4 years of denial, he's already chewed up two of the 11 years that we have until 2030. Remember the famous clock that started ticking to global reductions by 2030. Remember that whole story? That was 2018, right? We've already lost 2 years because of Trump's intransigence and complete, we don't have to get into it. But I saw an article that compared the election of Biden as a watershed moment to things like the Apollo 11 landing, or the Berlin Wall, where things have begun to shift, right? Where the rest of the world is out there, already kind of knows where we're going. When the president of the United States, to the extent he has the power, gets behind it, I mean, that is something that could shift global opinion. I mean, I continue to think that there was a tweet I saw today where Biden had a phone call with the Pope. And in the readout of the phone call with the Pope, which, of course, Trump never did readouts because he was too busy taking orders from Putin. But the readout between the Pope and Joe Biden, two paragraphs long, and in that two paragraphs, it says, we're going to work together on climate change. So, okay, maybe. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah,
I'm hopeful.
That's big. I mean, it's certainly big because I feel like I know that the Pope had a lot to say and was really persuasive, right, with the encyclical that he did. When was that? Back in 2015, he wrote an encyclical about the importance of addressing climate change and how much he's behind it. And then it was real. For me, it seemed that there was some silence on climate, and so from the Pope. And now it's good to hear that he's back in the headlines, working with the new president elect. Anyway,
So I guess the point that I think is important to make is the following. There are myriad articles floating around out there in the ether right now about what Joe Biden can do on day one. And we, in fact, contributed to that last week by talking about all the things that Joe Biden can do. The signs look pretty good in the sense that some of the articles talk about how Joe Biden will incorporate climate into all of the federal departments, whether they're traditionally been climate or not, like the agricultural department, the labor department, all these things now have climate as a marker in what they're trying to do. And it goes along with the argument we've always made, I think, Mariah, that climate touches everything. So everything should be touching on climate. But there's a little bit of a cautionary tale. And the way I would put it, and Mariah, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I see, Joe Biden is human. He's a politician. They say about politicians, they have to feel the heat before they see the light, right? I mean, Joe Biden took on the climate movement because people were pushing him hard and he saw an opportunity. But people, the Sunrise Movement was there. Everyone was trying to get Joe Biden to accept climate. And he had. Joe Biden has not been a climate hawk for the last 30 or 40 years, right? He's a politician. He's following which way he's being pressured, right? Would you agree with that, Mariah?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think even if you look at his climate, in the Democratic primaries, he was one of the worst, he had one of the lowest grades for his climate policy out of all of the candidates. And once he became the nominee, candidates like Tom Steyer and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders really, I think, leaned on him and influenced him to do a big overhaul of his climate approach. And I assume that he did that because he saw it as a way to get votes.
Some
of those Sanders on board.
My analysis, if I cast my mind back to last May and June, Bernie and Elizabeth Warren had detailed plans, as Jay Inslee had, right? Inslee had the perfect plan.
Oh, yeah, they took Inslee. Right,
and then Inslee. Warren picked it up.
Sorry,
and when Inslee, Warren dropped out, Biden had to unite the party, right? Yeah. He had to pull it. And so one of the things he did was to say, okay, you guys care that much about climate, we'll talk about climate, right? Again, this is not to criticize Joe Biden, but is to support what I think is the central point, is that we need to keep the pressure on Mr. Biden. Right. President Biden will. There's so many. That's what makes this topic so interesting. There's this whole side thread of who should be the head of the Department of Energy in the new Biden administration. Of course, who's the head of the Department of Energy now? It's soft shoe Ron Perry, right? The governor of Texas, who was on Dancing with the Stars, wanted to eliminate the Department of Energy. Couldn't remember that he wanted to get rid of the Department of Energy. Then he finds out, oh, it controls the nuclear weapons. Well, that too. Okay. So, all right. Who's going to be in charge?
Affiliated with Exxon, right? He was affiliated with Exxon.
He was over dancing around in Ukraine trying to sell natural gas to the Ukraine. I mean, the guy, well, anyway, Ron Perry is kind of a joke. But the question is who would Biden appoint? Is it Ron? Say again?
I think it's Rick.
Rick Perry. Thank you. Thank you, Mariah. That's why I'm glad
you're
here.
You have so much in that brilliant mind of yours, so I don't blame you.
Rick Perry, yes. Dancing with the Stars, Rick Perry. So for Biden, he has to pick somebody to be the Secretary of Energy, which is a very important job because it controls research and development. It does all kinds of things. Two of the choice can be presented as, should he take Jay Inslee, avowed climate hawk, knows what he wants to do, has the executive and intellectual capacity to be Secretary of Energy, or should he go back to the Obama administration and pick Ernie Moniz, who was the guy with the Washington, the George Washington hairstyle, who helped negotiate the Iran deal? Okay. Two very smart guys, but Ernie Moniz has deep connections, for better or worse, to the fossil fuel industry. He purports to be this middle of the ground academic guy, but he's got real roots in the fossil fuel industry. And so now Joe Biden has to pick these two guys. He likes Ernie Moniz because he worked with him under the Obama administration. They're all buddies, right, from way back. But is that who we want? So I guess I'm saying this to illustrate the point that Joe Biden is a politician. He's going to pick people. As they say, personnel is policy, right? So whoever's head of the Department of Energy, you want that person to be as green as possible. And how are we going to make sure that Joe Biden knows that we all think that Jay Inslee is the right guy, right?
Biden's speaking of doing the dance. He's not dancing with the stars. He's dancing with Pennsylvania, right? And that was, Pennsylvania put him, I mean, not entirely Pennsylvania. I think the verdict is still out about Georgia and Arizona and stuff like that. But certainly Pennsylvania was critical in the election. And Pennsylvanians, a lot of those voters were concerned about him because they were afraid he was going to push too hard on climate action, and they wanted someone who could promise them that fracking was still going to be a thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the final presidential debate, he promised, you know, he said, I have not said I'm going to get rid of fracking. I support fracking. Go fracking. I mean, I don't know if this was exactly his word.
Something like that.
But you know, he's doing a dance there where he wants to honor his constituents. He wants to honor the people that that voted him in, and not alienate Pennsylvania in a large degree. I mean, I'm sure it's not just about Pennsylvania, but so he's got a careful dance there that he has to weigh as well. And I think, again, it just goes back to the importance of him hearing more loudly and more clearly from as many people as can that this is what we do. Like you said, we demand Jay Inslee. We demand real serious and earnest action on climate.
And so this is where it gets interesting, and it comes, the rubber hits the road in a sense. There was an article in the New York Times this past Sunday where they interviewed Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I don't know if you got a chance to scan that one, Mariah. But basically, there is this sort of circular firing squad being formed up in the Democratic Party where the centrists and the progressives are going to be mad at each other over who lost the down ballot races, right? How come Jamie Harrison didn't get in? How come they didn't beat Joni Ernst in Iowa, right? What Ocasio-Cortez is saying is that the Democratic Party, and I would say climate activists, need to build up a continuing grassroots power between elections, right? All the time. And we need to, that grassroots effort needs to be focused on making sure that the politicians in office hear the voice of the people. So there is a need for climate hawks to be vociferous in demanding that that the right policies are put in place. And how does a climate hawk do that? A climate hawk does that by joining a climate organization. Right? I don't care which one you want, but go find one and be part of the movement, right? Be aligned with other people who can exert some kind of influence. And I think it starts with your representative in Congress, your senator, up to the White House. We need to be continuously vocal. And I mean, in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected, I was overjoyed and relieved, thinking that the problem was solved and everything was goodness and light. We were headed for the land of milk and honey. I can get one more analogy in there if I really put, anyway, I thought everything was over, and basically everyone took a deep breath. And I don't think that we can allow ourselves to do that, because Obama was eventually stymied, right? Obama had the all of the above policy. We need to continue the pressure on President Biden, good man that he is, but he needs to be kept on a short leash. Let me put it that way, right? We need to make sure that he knows that what we expect him to do. And the only way we do that is by staying organized and staying vocal. Is that craziness,
and
Mariah?
You know what? No, I think it's right on point. I think the other thing, Catherine Hayhoe is a big proponent of this. We need to talk to each other about climate change. It needs to be something that we are speaking with our neighbors, our friends, whoever we can about it. And, you know, of course, the best way is not to go spouting facts about climate change, but to find ways to connect with people about it so that it resonates with them, right? Maybe they like to ski and you can talk about the snowpack, or maybe they're a diver and you talk about the coral reefs, right? But finding ways to connect with people, or, you know, they're a parent and they're concerned about their child's future, all of these different avenues, but finding ways to connect with people about it is really important. I did find, you know, again, the Yale Climate Opinion Maps are such a fantastic resource out of the Yale Climate Change Communication Organization. And I found that number, 56% of the nation think that a presidential candidate's views on global warming are important to their vote. So that's good, but really only just a little over half of the population. So that needs to come a lot higher. But then also, I think it was only about 30% of the population feel comfortable talking about climate change with someone else. So yes, join a climate organization, but also talk about climate whenever you can, right? It touches everything. And so it's something you can bring into all all of your conversations. And it's critical. You know, you mentioned the, what is it? It's the atomic clock, whatever, the doomsday clock. That's it. The doomsday clock, which is getting closer and closer to doomsday, which is, you know, a depressing approach. But the other thing that I had read about was the World Scientists Warning to Humanity, which first came out 30 years ago from the Union of Concerned Scientists, as well as 1,700 independent scientists, basically saying that if we don't change how we interact with the natural world, we will endure vast human misery. That was what they said. And, you know, they, in 2017, they issued another report that says, yeah, well, we haven't really actually done anything since the past 30 years to avoid that vast human misery. And, you know, now we're in trouble. So, you know, it's really important. It's really important to be talking about these things anywhere and everywhere and always.
I agree. So dear listener, please take that to heart. I think that there's an article of Dave Roberts at Vox saying that with the election of Biden, we've gone from climate-wise being completely screwed over to being having like this long, desperate chance if we work hard enough, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the game is not over. There's a long way to go. We cannot rest on our laurels. I mean, the man's not even inaugurated yet, but we need to keep pushing because there's so much to be done. And talking about climate, being active, it's the right way to do it. It's the way we keep pressure on these guys. So we will put up links to, we talked about a lot of stuff, Mara. I covered a lot of ground tonight. We'll put up links to most of it on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. It's good reading. It's good things, good way to view the world. You can send us your method for putting pressure on the president. Send us an idea to an email at podcast@massclimateaction.net. We would love to know good ways to influence the incoming president-elect. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or any of the modern podcast distribution apps. Of course, we're also on Apple Podcasts. Look for Massachusetts Climate Action Network. I want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of those things, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. Mariah, thank you so much for being here and discussing the ins and outs of presidential politics.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. Hang in there. The fight's just begun. Take care.
Very cool.